David Tarpley, an attorney with the Legal Aid Society. This is May 20th, 2008.
My first exposure to legal aid was as a second-year law student at Vanderbilt. In the fall of 1969, I participated in the legal clinic program at Vanderbilt, through which I was assigned to work at the old Legal Services of Nashville office, which was in the Stallman Building. And I did that through the school year. And then in the summer of 1969, I became employed with Legal Aid as a student clerk. Continued to do that through the following school year, graduated in 71, and became licensed, and have been with Legal Services of Nashville and its successors ever since.
Okay, so it was your experiences there that made you decide to go into this?
Yes, field? Yes.
I see. But what were those early cases like?
Pretty much like the ones we have today. although back then we did just about anything we felt that we could handle. We didn't have the restrictions on cases we were allowed to handle that we have today, and we didn't have the structured what we call case priorities that we have today. That is, certain things we do and certain things we don't do. But one thing we did a lot of in the early years that we do not now do was federal civil rights litigation. I couldn't tell you how many suits we brought, but it was well up in number, probably, and I'm just talking about the Middle Tennessee program.
Sure.
Probably 60 or more civil rights actions in the first 10 to 12 years of our existence.
Okay. So, give me an example of one of those cases. I mean, not specifically, but when you say civil rights actions, what are you referring to?
Well, these were all actions against government agencies or representatives of government agencies. Or in some cases, government-funded agencies that were doing things or not doing things that we felt detrimentally affected our clients' rights. One of the more colorful cases was an action brought against all of the judges of the Metropolitan General Sessions Courts of Davidson County, Tennessee, in the early December of 1971. Because at that time, Metro Nashville was not applying what was then the two-year-old U.S. Supreme Court decision in Williams versus Illinois, in which the Supreme Court had held that persons convicted of municipal offenses could not be incarcerated without being given a reasonable opportunity to pay fines over a period of time, mm-hmm. that you couldn't use incarceration in lieu of fines without giving a poor person a chance to pay. Having been unable to resolve that issue without bringing suit, we brought that suit with against all of the Metropolitan General Sessions judges. The case was settled fairly quickly. In fact, it was resolved by consent decree within a month, and that consent decree is actually still in effect in Davidson County, although it's not statewide. And then the following month, we had occasion to bring a contempt citation against a particular judge who was refusing to follow it. That consent action never did have to go to hearing on the merits, but bringing that one and obtaining a temporary restraining order persuaded all of them that we meant business and we really were going to enforce our decree. There were many actions against the state of Tennessee, primarily the welfare department. Mm-hmm. Fred Friend, who died only a few weeks ago and was the commissioner of welfare in Tennessee for about 6 years, because of his position, of course, was the named defendant on quite a few of those cases. But we brought actions when needed against all kinds of entities. We brought a few against the against MDHA, the Metropolitan Development Housing Agency, when we felt our clients were being treated not in accordance with the law and we couldn't resolve it otherwise. We brought an action against Metro for not following another Supreme Court mandate to do away with durational residency requirements for indigent care. That was brought again on behalf of a woman who had arrived from another country, was almost ready to deliver a baby, whose sponsor abandoned her once she got here, and who then could not get admitted to deliver her baby. We brought many, many actions of that kind back in those days. We don't do them now because they are fee generating, and private attorneys who bring them do earn fees from them, and that's something we've gotten away from in favor of the private bar, so that they will both bring them and collect their fees. Another thing, of course, we can't take fees anymore. That's been the case since 1996. We did, in fact, at one time supplement our budget heavily on structured fee arrangements resulting from the successful conclusion of some of those cases. But of course, we cannot do that now.
When you first came to the Stallman Building, sort of walk me through that. How is legal aid set up?
Well, I guess it was legal aid opened its doors in early 1968 mm-hmm. on the sixth floor of the Stallman Building, which was rather an older and eclectic office building occupied by people in many different occupations, but I suppose more lawyers than anything else. Initially, there were six attorneys in the program, including the director. And law clerks like myself. And of course, a small support staff. The total I'm going to call it legal services because the sure. name was Legal Services of Nashville then. The total budget for the first two or three years for the whole program was about $100,000. When I began as an attorney in the fall of 71, my starting salary per monthly was $700 a month. It was until 1970, our only office was the Stallman Building office. Mm-hmm. In 1970, we opened two branches in Nashville, one in South Nashville on Music Row, and the other in North Nashville, in the basement of the Matthew Walker Health Center on Herman Street. The South Nashville office remained open until 75 or 6, and the North Nashville branch about a year longer. And then for a while we had no actual branches until the expansion of legal services took hold. And that was, of course, as a result of the passage of the Legal Services Corporation Act, which became effective in 1975. And the mandate of Congress to LSC under that act was to establish some level of indigent civil legal aid funding throughout the nation. And it was at that time that we expanded our program from Davidson County to 14 counties. And we established three out-of-county branches. That was during 77 and 78, we opened three branches, Murfreesboro, Gallatin, and Clarksville.
Okay. How did you come to choose those particular places?
It was partly geographic and partly demographic, mm-hmm. combination of distance, accessibility, and eligible client population. And to some extent, the political and legal atmosphere of the different potential locations involved.
So when Legal Services Corporation was founded, how did, what, I mean, that was obviously more money.
Well, yes, it was, it, well, the main effect was that after LSC was running, up and running, and began putting out requests for proposal, those RFPs, as they're called, were for sizable service areas. So they weren't interested in anyone bidding on Davidson County. They wanted a bid on a 14-county area, which included Davidson County. So if you wanted to be a recipient of LSC funds, you had to submit a bid in accordance with that RFP for that 14-county area. And then that was true all over the country. Until then, we had been funded, of course, simply to provide service to Davidson County.
Okay.
And we had several different funding umbrellas in the early years. We began under the old Office of Economic Opportunity, which was one of the bedrock funding agencies of the War on Poverty, established under the Lyndon Johnson administration. After President Nixon saw to the demise of the Office of Economic Opportunity in 1972, we were for a while funded through the Department of Agriculture, which we thought was somewhat interesting. We contemplated whether we should wear blue jeans and straw hats to work, but we decided not to do that. And then when LSC, of course, was set up and running, our funding came through LSC. But now all along, of course, legal services and legal aid have been set up as a nonprofit charitable Tennessee corporation. That's been true from the very beginning, with an executive director and a board of directors, which of course is chosen like other nonprofit boards, and the members serve on a rotating basis.
Well, tell me about your first big case, the one that stands out.
I suppose my first big case was as co-counsel on Harding versus Doyle, the one I told you about, against all of the Metro General Sessions judges.
What is that like, going in and filing a case against every General Sessions judge?
Well, it was a little scary. It really was, because we weren't well accepted by the bar and the establishment. I mean, we were regarded, as with some justification, as a bunch of young Turks and radicals, and you know, I mean, we even had an office in South Nashville at 14th and Horton that we named the Law Reform Office. That wouldn't happen today. We were literally watching where we went and how we drove, and looking to see if we were being followed by an official-looking car, because we really didn't know how vehement the local reaction would be to something like that. And the Nashville Tennessean knew about the issue and knew that the case was in preparation. And for a week before the case was filed, they had run stories on the general background topic without mentioning that a case was coming. Mm-hmm. And that they ran a story every day for a week before the case was filed. And then the case was filed, and that resulted in a big headline story. Yeah. With the picture of on the front page, the picture of a federal judge on one side and one of the General Sessions judges on the other side. And they had them positioned so that they were staring across the page at each other. It was somewhat exciting for us. It felt strange, because of course so many of our cases are, and always will be, such routine, fairly small cases. Mm-hmm. Perhaps not so small to our clients, to whom $500 may be a great deal of money.
Sure.
But it was quite a contrast. And this is one thing about the job that I've always appreciated, is the huge contrast in things I can do.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried to make sure that I've mixed my job up so that I'm in enough different places and atmospheres I served 2.5 years in our Murfreesboro branch in the early 80s as a part-time attorney there. When we couldn't staff it to its proper level, I served 10 years as interim managing attorney in our Gallatin branch.
10 years
as an interim managing attorney. And anytime anyone dropped the interim, I reminded them to put it back in. From 92 until 2002. And for 4 years, the first 4 years of that, there were no resident attorneys in the Gallatin office at all. It was me, Dave Ettinger, and Kitty Calhoun doing a day a week each, me doing half time, and a very solid support staff, and that was it. Mm-hmm. It's deja vu now, because as of last Thursday, I agreed to become interim managing attorney of Gallatin, because we're not replacing Jim Hawkins. At least not for the foreseeable future. Mm-hmm. And there has to be a managing attorney for the office to remain open. So, mm-hmm. But there will be no resident attorney because Andre has just been moved down to Nashville as his base of operation.
Okay.
Yeah. So for Pat Dunnigan, who is a veteran out there, and myself, it's deja vu, back to the 92.
Okay. Well, which cases, I mean, you obviously deal with a lot of different types of cases. Yeah. Which ones do you, for lack of a better word, enjoy?
Oh, well, of course, I concentrate in consumer protection.
Sure.
And have since the early 70s, 74, actually. And that's what I enjoy. When we first decided in 1974 that to get more bang for the buck out of our service delivery, we would try to concentrate in different areas and become more adroit in those areas. I had already realized in my first 3 years of practice that I enjoyed commercial work and specifically consumer protection more than anything else I did.
Sure.
So I staked that out. I said, I've got dubs on consumer protection, and no one else wanted it. So that's... I started concentrating in consumer protection at that time. And one thing led to another. In 86, I accepted an adjunct position at Vanderbilt Law School, and I still hold that. I teach, now I teach consumer credit protection at Vanderbilt. For the first 5 years, I did clinic work there. And just last year, I accepted another position. I'm also going to be teaching consumer protection at the Nashville School of Law beginning this fall, although I won't teach both at the same time. I'll only do it, you know, each school every other year.
Sure.
But that's more variety. I enjoy teaching. I don't think I'd want to make a living at it, but I enjoy it. But the area of law that I always enjoy the most is consumer protection, and over the past decade, predatory lending has taken more and more of that in terms of our time demand. Predatory lending really got its start, at least on the surface, after the so-called deregulation of the first Reagan administration came in 1981, when the whole atmosphere at the state and the federal level was to deregulate and allow the free market system to take its course and follow its natural laws. Well, yeah, the problem with that is that the forces that control the free market system are somewhat unbalanced, and the interests of poor people are at the low end of that balance. They are not adequately represented, and I think that the current legal scheme in which we see so many very high yield lenders at every stage of the game is a result of that. You know, I wouldn't have dreamed in 30 years ago that we would now have an industry that can operate under the total legal sanction of law, charging 264% per annum on loans against car titles. Or an industry that can legally take a check, discount it on a smaller cash loan, hold it for 2 weeks and charge an effective rate of about 280%. No one would have dreamed 30 years ago that that kind of atmosphere, legal atmosphere, would prevail, but today it does. Those industries, of course, have been validated by the state legislature and can do those and do them routinely. Again, in the mortgage area, it's a little more complicated because so much of what happens in the predatory mortgage lending field is sort of not so much allowed by the law, it's just unregulated. Much of what I deal with in terms of governing law, we have to make it up as we go along because it's hard to point to a specific statute that's been violated, and yet folks have been done out of their homes and out of their equity and have basically lost the only wealth they'll ever have. And how do you address that? In many cases, we can point to black letter law that helps, but in so many cases, we can't.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the organization. What do you consider the milestone events?
Well, the first big milestone event was the creation of LSC and the expansion into 14 counties.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, milestones? I'll go back a little bit before that.
Sure.
I suppose the first big milestone would be the naming of Ashley Wilshire as executive director. That was in 1976. Before that, we had had an original director who served for about 3 years. Then we had 2 weak directors, one of which lasted about 2.5 years, one less than a year, and both of which nearly brought the whole organization to ruin. Then Walt Kurtz for 2 years, but then he went off to do other things.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ashley Wilshire, of course, resigned last year.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say that was the first big milestone. The second big milestone was the creation of LSC and the expansion into the 14-county area. The third milestone was probably financial, and that we had big financial increases in funding through the rest of the 70s, which actually set us on a footing which enabled us to survive without even laying off when the Graham-Rudman budget cuts hit, beginning in 1981. And in 1981, the Graham-Rudman budget cuts resulted for all domestic social service programs, including us, a reduction of anywhere from 30 to 100% of funding. We were in the lucky group that only had the 30% cut. Some agencies disappeared entirely. Some perhaps deserve to disappear entirely. That's another story. We took a 30% cut. I suppose the next milestone was by and large, from our standpoint, not a positive one, and that was the advent of the myriad of LSC restrictions in 1996 due to the enormous change in the political climate resulting from the, it's called the Nude Revolution in 1994, when midway through Clinton's first term, of course, the Republicans gained control of both houses of Congress for the first time since the Eisenhower administration. And, as a result of that, many restrictions were placed on us that had been talked about before, but no one had had the political power to put them across. And as a result of those restrictions, of course, we cannot do many things that we used to be able to do. And also, on a nationwide basis, many dedicated people left Civil Legal Aid, who had been a part of it before. The best local example is Gordon Bonniman founding the Tennessee Justice Center, primarily as a result of the many restrictions that, in his case, would absolutely prevent him from conducting the kind of practice that he had been doing for years. So it's not a positive, but it was a milestone.
Sure.
I can't really think of any other particular milestones until last year when, of course, Ashley resigned and Gary came in.
There was the merger.
Oh, I'm sorry, of course. Yes, the merger. That has to be included. The merger was, mergers were done late nationwide, and they were the result of the efforts of the then president of LSC, whose last, John something, I can't remember his last name, who was adamant that there were too many programs in the country. And it was inefficient to operate with so many different programs when many times they were doing the same things, using the same techniques, trying to serve the same client population. And in every state, this occurred to some extent, some more than others. And in some states, it did cause enormous hardship. There were states in which, or so we heard, mergers almost brought about the ruin of civil legal aid because of all the infighting that occurred between boards, between staffs, between directors. That didn't happen in Tennessee. We were quite fortunate. Our program merged with two others in 2001. We merged with Rural Legal Services, which had served the very large area from Anderson County west to what was then our line at Trousdale in Cannon Counties. And we also merged with the program that had existed from the south of us down to the Alabama and Georgia lines. And those three service areas combined resulted in a 48 county service area, which we have today. We were able to retain most of the staffs of those two programs, with whom we were well familiar because, of course, we had been working across program lines for many years. And we felt that our merger was quite successful and relatively painless. And I think LSC has held up our merger as an example of what they had envisioned mergers being like. And I have to say, I think that the success of the merger was due primarily to the strong leadership in the programs involved at the time. And I think probably more credit needs to go to Ashley Wiltshire than any other single individual for seeing that it was successfully accomplished.
Okay. All right, so between the LSC expansion into 14 counties and the Graham Rudman 30% cut, you guys were getting more money.
Yeah, there were significant increases during the years of the Carter administration.
Sure.
And those put us, those together with the attorney fees we were taking in on our civil rights matters, put us in a good, firm financial footing. We were able to tide through the first two or three years after the Grand Rudman cuts without having to lay off anyone or close any offices. And that wasn't true in many programs. We thought we might have to. We even formed a committee. We called it the Doomsday Committee. that was supposed to plan against eventualities such as having to perhaps close an office. I was the head of the Doomsday Committee. And Ashley used to chide me in later years that the Doomsday Committee never been and did anything. And I said, well, Ashley, let me ask you this. Did any offices close? Well, no. Did anyone get laid off? Well, no. Well, then how can you say the committee was unsuccessful? I said, sometimes the best action is to not take any action. So that he agreed that that was a good point. But
well, after the cuts, though, in the, I guess, before the restrictions in 96, you were legal aid had to adjust the types of cases they were taking, I'm assuming.
Well, actually, that came before. For about as long as LSC has existed, LSC recognized from the beginning that no one could do everything.
Sure.
And one of the requirements for LSC funding has always been that every field program receiving funds have what are called case priorities adopted by its board of directors. And those are simply a decision, and quite often it's on an office-by-office basis as to which kinds of cases will be handled and which won't. And that there are two primary reasons for that. One is to have a rational basis for deciding which cases which cases are in the most demand in that area in terms of the problems of the clients, and which can best be addressed with the resources we can bring to them. And it's also to provide a rational and relatively fair way for determining who will not get served. Mm-hmm. So that rather than deciding ad hoc on the basis of each individual application, whether you feel like taking that case or not. If it's a case of a certain kind and it has enough merit that we feel the time can be well spent, we take it. If it's a case not of a kind that we take, we don't take it. And that's it.
Sure.
There's no debating whether we should take it or not. We just don't take it. Now, we may be able to refer them somewhere else, but we don't handle them. But those restrictions that we call case priorities have existed as long as we've had LSC regulations. And we look at those priorities regularly. Every 2 years, we go through a process of looking again at what are our case priorities. Do we need to adjust them in one office or another? Should something be added? Should something be dropped? So that's a fluid process. It's not just a stagnant thing.
Okay.
But we are required to maintain them and periodically review them. And each case handler actually signs a statement that has to be on file for LSC review that case handler will not accept cases outside of the established priorities of the office. I'm not sure that anybody ever looks at those statements, but I assume Pat Roland has them on file somewhere.
Well, let's hope. Okay. We talked about your first big case. What about you've been here with? 30 years or so?
More than that. 37.
37
years. Yeah. I suppose a series of cases, and it's all sort of under one collective thing, although it was actually about 18 cases,
mm-hmm.
Against the same interlocking group of companies that were brought over about a 2.5 year period in the 80s. And we refer to them collectively as the season sash cases because of the name of the primary corporation. The season sash companies were actually three interlocking corporations that were actually all owned by the same individual. They were based in Kentucky and Lexington. And what they did was to manufacture replacement doors and windows, which were then marketed by home solicitation sales techniques in about 7 states, including Tennessee. I don't know just when they started functioning. We started getting requests for help on season sash matters in 1985. Late spring of 85. And the method of operation was not too unlike many such companies. We don't see so many today, but saw a lot then, except more egregious. There was a company that manufactured the windows, and there was a company that sold the windows, and there was a company that did some of their financing, because of course their almost all of their jobs were financed, almost none were cash. And the sales techniques were rather draconian. The initial contacts would be made either by phone or by postcard, and if those initial contacts resulted in an interview at the home, the promise was always that the interview wouldn't take over an hour. And the company would try to set up the in-home interviews for around 6 p.m. or so, with the promise it wouldn't take over an hour. In fact, a team of two salesmen would go, and quite often they would be monitored by someone watching from somewhere not far away. If they stayed less than 4 hours without getting a sale, their compensation was docked. They were penalized for that. 4 hours.
Four hours, right.
Well, of course, we learned many, many things through discovery in the litigation. That's one of many things we learned. They would promise anything. They had a very slick, glossy sales presentation. Many folks said we finally signed because we couldn't get him out of the house. Many of their targets were elderly people. Not all, but many. Many of them were people on fixed income living alone. We never really established how they did their targeting for marketing, but it was quite obvious that it was leaned heavily toward the elderly and the disabled. These contracts, once they were signed, when people actually studied them, if they could figure them out, what they finally realized was that they had signed up to buy doors and windows, which in some cases that we got in cost exceeded the value of the homes. Their paperwork was very voluminous. They had much more paperwork than the law required, and we see that sometimes. It's a way of trying to disguise what's going on. I mean, sure. You get such a mountain of paper, you're discouraged from even trying to figure it out. They did install the doors and windows, which were of low to average quality. They weren't especially good. They didn't carry as good a warranty as nearly anything you can buy locally. But the main problems were in the financing. Mm-hmm. And this is what got most people in trouble. They would, in all cases, record mortgages, deeds of trust. As I said, one of their interlocking companies carried some of their paper internally. The rest was all sold to banks throughout the Southeast. Many people were losing their homes as a result of these deals. We ended up, before we were through, we ended up with 18 different households as clients. Some were individual homeowners, single, and some were families, some were couples. Of all 18 clients that we took, and we brought suit on all of them over that period of time, mostly in federal court, two or three in state court, but where they had facts that we thought were especially well suited to state court. No one lost their home, and no one among our clients paid any more once they became our clients, and they all eventually got their mortgages released. When we'd been litigating with them for about a year, they went into bankruptcy. The three corporations all filed Chapter 11 corporate bankruptcies in Lexington. Well, we weren't finished with them. We had all these cases pending, so I got myself admitted to the Federal District, Eastern District of Kentucky, so that I could litigate in the bankruptcy court there. And off we went, chasing them into Kentucky. And the result of that was that we did get very good settlements on the cases that were involved in the that were caught up in the bankruptcy. Of course, those were potential liabilities of the company, and they had to disclose them as such. And of course, we filed claims, and we were able to get those resolved well. But by the time it was over, as I say, for us, that began in late spring of 85 and went through to about the end of 87 before we wrapped up the last ones. We weren't the only ones. The attorneys general in several states were active. The Tennessee attorney general had a bunch of claims, and they were adjudicating their claims, although they were more limited in what they could address, because by statute, their jurisdiction is limited to only certain laws that they can enforce, whereas, of course, ours, we could do anything, and we did. The common ground for all of our cases, the one common issue that put us into federal court whenever we wanted to take them in was they had a law firm draw up their paperwork to comply with Truth in Lending that they thought was foolproof, but it wasn't. They left a chink in their Truth in Lending armor, which gave us the opportunity to bring a meritorious Truth in Lending statutory rescission claim on all of them. And it was failure to disclose a particular charge they were pocketing in every case. And once we figured out what that was, we had the key. It took me a little while, but I figured out what it was. And once we had that, we had federal court jurisdiction. And through that, of course, we could bring our other claims for fraud, deception, et cetera, in the same case. But it was wonderful to have that federal court jurisdiction in order to take them in and take them there and put them there, because that ups the ante considerably. An interesting sideline of those cases, and I don't mind saying it now, was I suspected after a while that these companies had underworld connections. Mm-hmm. When we'd been litigating for several months, a fellow who had been involved in their local office, they'd had a local branch in Nashville open for a few months and then they'd closed it, but they'd continued to market their products even after that office closed. A person who had been connected with that office, whose name I had gotten from discovery, knew about our cases and called me up one day, said he wanted to meet with me. I said, what for? Well, I have some things to share with you. I said, well, you want to come up to the office? Oh, no, I can't do that. I said, where do you want to meet? And he described this parking lot up on one of those office complexes off Elm Hill Pike. I said, you want to meet in a parking lot? He said, yes. I said, when? He said, sundown. I thought, But he was serious. And I thought, well, what the heck? So I agreed. So I went out there. And sure enough, he was there. And it was like something out of the movies. He was very afraid. He was visibly shaking. And he said, look, whatever it is I can tell you, I just want to tell you now. I don't want you taking my deposition or anything. I said, well, I'll try to arrange that. Depends on what you can tell me. So he told me a lot of internal information about the companies. He said, you know who you're litigating with, don't you? I said, well, I'm beginning to have an idea. Mm-hmm. And he said, you're litigating with the mob. And if they knew I was meeting with you and giving information, I would be a dead man. I said, okay, well, thanks for telling me that. So he went on his way the next day back at the office. There was an intake review, and several attorneys were sitting around the library table. And I thought, I'm going to have a little fun. And I said, oh, by the way, guys, those Season Sash cases, found out who we're litigating with. They said, who? I said, the mob. And all of a sudden there was dead silence around the table. Nobody said anything, and I thought, yeah, I know what you guys are all thinking. You're in your mind, you're trying to measure the distance from your office to mine. So if it's just a small bomb, maybe you won't go as well. Anyway, I'd already suspected it, but I fully believed the man. I, you know, he was very scared, but he didn't seem like he was lying. Actually, I had confirmation of it about a year later. I'd been working some with the Kentucky Attorney General's office in their consumer fraud unit, and one of their criminal investigators told me that, yes, indeed, you had been litigating with the mob.
Maybe the mob was into sashes and door.
I had suspected for some time that this operation was largely a money laundering front because it had all the earmarks of a classic money laundering front. Now, this isn't the only time that I'm fairly certain I litigated with a company that was a money laundering front. I could tell you about another one here locally, but that's what I believe was happening. That particular person, that investigator, also shared with me the fact that the company's equipment, trucks and all, you know, which were hauling equipment, were also being used to haul large quantities of drugs from the Miami up to the Midwest through that corridor. And the president of the company, whom Drake and I deposed one day here in Nashville, along with three of his henchmen. We had subpoenaed them to Nashville for depositions in some of these cases. The president of the company, I learned after all of our litigation was done, had been convicted and sent to federal prison on big time drug charges. He had also done time in prison before we ever got involved with him. I knew that, but I didn't know when or how. I knew it had happened sometime earlier. Eventually, I did find out how through one of the local TV personalities who was digging into his past. Turns out this same gentleman, long before our cases came up, had operated a similar type operation in West Virginia and had been convicted on criminal truth in lending charges. There is, in fact, a little-known criminal provision in the Truth in Lending Act, through which individuals actually can be convicted of criminal offenses and violating truth in lending. There have been very few prosecutions under that in the history of the law, but apparently his was one of them. And he had already done time for criminal truth in lending convictions. And here we were, of course, handling all these civil actions based upon truth in lending violations. But those were probably professionally the most interesting single series of cases I've done. Perhaps the most satisfying to me were another series of cases we began in around 91 against a collection agency operating in one of the surrounding counties here, Wilson County to be exact. And we ended up bringing five federal cases against this same agency and its owner operator, who was a woman. The first of those cases was brought to me by the attorney then staff in the Gallatin office. And when I saw it in 1990, I thought, this is a joke. Somebody has put this together to put my, you know, to pull my chain. This is not happening. And it was happening. It was some of the most egregious, outright extortion, usury, due process violations, you name it. You know, if you read the Fair Debt Collection Act from back to front, it would be hard to find anything they were in compliance with. And this woman was operating openly in Wilson County. She was collecting city utility accounts, for one thing, and with the open collusion of the city of Lebanon. Old electric accounts. And I'm talking about, you know, accounts that were from years past, service that had been in another place. if she had a debtor who owed one of those from past service somewhere else. She would give them 24 hours to pay it. And if they didn't, one of the city of Lebanon service trucks would go out and cut off the power. Just like that. I mean, that was it. She just called up whoever it was at the city and said, this one hadn't paid, go cut his power off. On the current service, another billing somewhere else. She was threatening, she was taking checks, post-dated checks, and threatening people with jail right and left. I mean, everyone told us that. She was bundling accounts. If she'd get three or four accounts on the same debtor from different merchants, she would wrap them all up into one lawsuit, brought in the name of her company, and would just out of the thin air impose an interest rate of, say, 24% on the whole thing back from whenever, even though they weren't even interest-bearing accounts. And the courts were actually giving her judgments on these. I could go on and on, but you get the idea. And this stuff was operating right in the open in Wilson County. Well, the person who referred some clients to us was actually the city attorney, who knew that this was totally illegal. Couldn't get anyone locally to do anything, including his own administration, and thought maybe we could help. So after I looked at the first two households he sent us and got their stories together, they both had City of Lebanon utility accounts. And both, one of them had actually been cut off and restored, the other one had threatened. And I said to him, look, you know the city's in complicity here. He said, yeah, I know. So I drew up a federal 1983 civil rights complaint against the city of Lebanon. Drew it up, didn't file it. Took it to him and said, okay, here's what you need. On the front, I took a big marker and I said, not filed, across the front. And I said, hand this to your bosses and read it to them. You can interpret it for them as you need to. And tell them that they have 72 hours to meet. And I gave him a list of conditions they had to meet. And I said, the next one they see will be just like this, except it will have a date file stamp and a clerk's docket number on it. That'll be the only difference. He said, I get the picture. So he took it to him. Didn't take 72 hours, took 48. He called me up and said, okay, they're rolling all the way over. Well, what that meant was they were, of course, dumping her as their collection agent. They were not going to do any further business with her, and they were turning over to us all of their records as to her collection activities, so that that would jumpstart our litigation. So, of course, that we didn't sue them. We didn't have to. And they were firmly in our corner, if not willingly, at least. Anyway, that was the beginning. We filed, and again, the Lebanon Democrat got all over this. I was surprised. I didn't think they'd care, but boy, they were just all over it. We filed, in the end, five cases. Now, the first three that we filed were filed fairly close together, and they were all basically the same as far as the horrible, horrible things this woman had been doing to these families. And those three were actually consolidated together for handling as one unit, and we mediated those. We had federal court mediation on those. And after we had taken some depositions and done some discovery, and the result was a nice financial settlement. Actually, what we did was, I think we limited out her Arizona emissions policy, because her E&O carrier was defending the suits. Mm-hmm. And the lawyer told me, you've drained the policy dry, basically. And I think that's so. I think that we probably got what we could get on that. But we got a financial settlement for all the clients and a big long injunction, permanent injunction in federal court, prohibiting her from doing this huge laundry list of things.
Sure.
Well, the other two cases we settled individually because they were too late to put in the consolidation. Well, I thought, well, that's that. That was fun. And then I got a call from a different source. The call was from an attorney who was assigned to represent the state, the Tennessee Collection Services Board. Tennessee is one of those states that does license collection agencies. Many don't. Mm-hmm. New York doesn't, surprisingly, but Tennessee does. And he told me who he was, and I said, well, nice to talk to you. What can I do for you? Well, we have brought a proceeding against, and he named this agency, to revoke their collector's license based upon the cases you handled. I said, well, I'm very glad to hear that. I don't think the agency ordinarily brings disciplinary action just based upon treatment of debtors, does it? He said, no, first one we've ever done. Because, you know, they'll go after them if the agency is cheating its own clients, the businesses, by not remitting all their funds. They'll take those licenses away. But they had never gone after one for abusing debtors before. So I was very pleased to hear that. I said, well, I'm really glad to hear that. I know my clients will be very glad to cooperate. Even though they've settled their cases, they will certainly be very happy to come and testify. Well, I'm sure they will. I'm sure they will. But actually, that's not why I'm calling you. And I start to get this feeling. I said, why are you calling me? Well, I'd like you to help me. I said, excuse me. I said, I've already helped you. I've done these cases. They're wrapped up, you know, on a silver platter. There they are. You know, what do you want? Well, we're going to have a hearing. I said, well, of course you're going to have a hearing. When is it? He told me the date. It was about 6 weeks away. I said, well, you know, just subpoena my clients. I mean, they'll love it. He said, oh, I know, but I need you there. And I thought, this isn't happening. He said, wait a minute. You're the one paid by the state. I'm the one paid by legal aid. It's not my job to represent the state. Oh, I know, but you know, the board would be happy for you to come and assist. I said, I don't know what the board would be happy about, but I don't think legal aid would be happy about it. He said, well, I got a solution for that. I said, what do you mean? He said, I can subpoena you. I said, excuse me? He said, I'm going to subpoena you. I said, you're kidding. He said, watch me. This story is all true. Every word. He did. A few days later, here comes my subpoena. Of course, the clients got subpoenaed too.
Sure.
But that was... So I go. I have no clue what's going to happen here, you know. So it starts, and the commission is 5 members. And he gets up and introduces himself, or she's there, the owner of the company, and she's represented by counsel. He gets up and introduces me, and tells who I am, and says, I'm there to assist. The board looks at me and says, I'm very happy to have you. I didn't exactly respond one way or the other. And then, having introduced me and saying that I'm going to present the case, he sits down. He sits down. I could have killed him. And there I am standing there, and the board looking at me, and the other attorney looking at me, you know. And I said, fine, whatever. I mean, he's got me here. What the heck? Can't leave.
So, under subpoena.
And I'm under subpoena. So I start putting my clients on the stand. Of course, I know the story is backwards and forwards. I mean, it's a piece of cake. It's no problem. So I put one on after the other, and he has the documents all there. So, you know, we introduce the letters and all that they all got, you know, everything that was pertinent. We just put it in systematically. It took about 5 hours. So to get it, all that stuff in the record. And so when I was finished, I rested, and then the other attorney put her on, and he did what he could, but there wasn't much he could do.
Sure.
I mean, she was cooked, and everybody knew it. Well, so when it was all done, it was the end of the day. And the only thing left was, you know, summations. So we adjourned for the day, and I was still under subpoena, so I had to go back the next morning and finish up. And so after the summations, the commission went into executive session, which meant we all had to skedaddle while they mulled over. And they only took about an hour. And then they called us back in, and they jerked her license, and they fined her. I mean, they gave it to her good. And, And under the law, she, of course, could appeal that administrative decision, which she did, but she lost the appeal. She appealed to Chancery Court. Well, that's a, that appeal is on the record. You know, it's only on the record. There's no new testimony. And she did lose that, although she almost won it because the state was late in filing some kind of response or other. But I was no longer involved. At this one, once the appeal was filed, it went to the Attorney General's office to handle. And they almost lost it through some procedural goof. But thank goodness the court let them off the hook. And so it was sustained, and of course her license wasn't restored. But as far as I know, that's still the only occasion where the state has revoked a Tennessee collector's license solely because of its abuse of debtors. As far as I know. Yeah, I've asked a couple of times since, and they've said, no, that was it. Well, I guess, you know, that was funny. Looking back, it was funny at the time, and it didn't seem all so funny, but I guess all's well that ends well, you know. And it is kind of an interesting story, but... Because I thought once we got all our federal cases signed and sealed and the money paid and the, you know, settlements entered, I thought that was it until this guy calls me up from the state.
Oh, man. That's crazy.
I mentioned one other case where I'm fairly sure that... there was a money laundering front. This was a long, long series of cases that I had with the same family, father and then son, for over 25 years. From a fairly well-known old family in Nashville. One of this fellow's siblings, brothers, was well-known as the kingpin of the Nashville numbers racket for many, many years. Jerry Poole, you may have heard his name. But his brother, I litigated with many times, and then later with his son, operated an erstwhile home improvement business. And just given the whole operation, the way it was set up and done, I felt fairly sure that at least in part it was a money laundering operation for the racket. Never had any proof of that. And it really wasn't directly pertinent to my cases anyway, but I feel fairly sure that's what I was dealing with. And knowing this family's reputation, I mean, these were folks that no contractor, no operating contractor would testify against as an expert witness, even though most of their work was, even if they eventually finished it, which was not at all certain, was very shoddy. But no one would testify because... they would say, look, I'm not going to testify against these people. I don't want my equipment burned at night. You know, I don't want my car sabotaged. I'm not going to get involved in this stuff. So that was always a problem. Mm-hmm. I had to rely on independent consultants who really had no local ties to the construction industry as such for expert witnesses. But this fella was... I felt fairly sure helping the family launder money through his erstwhile contracting business. But we had so many cases with him. I think he had sort of a grudging respect for me. At least he told me he did. Didn't like me, but I think he's old. But we probably had with him 30 cases over 25 years, and I had about 5 or 6 more with his son. His son's now in a humongous bankruptcy in and has been indicted on big-time criminal fraud charges. But that's as a result of ripping off big banks for huge sums. I asked the district attorney in Nashville at one point, having to do with a father, should I be concerned about my safety? And the DA I talked to said, let me get back to you about that. So he talked with some of his colleagues, and he called me back and said, we don't think so, because... we think that any kind of rough stuff the family has done has been confined to their own kind. We don't have any reason to think they would ever harm anybody who's purely, you know, not in the organization, is with law enforcement, or is totally on the table on the other side. We don't have any reason to think they would do that. Then, yeah, I didn't worry about it after that. But in my line of work, that is a consideration occasionally. And that's not the kind of thing you're going to hear from most of the people in this office. I'll tell you that. Except maybe occasionally the family law folks. I mean, they do get some weird people, you know, husbands and boyfriends on the other side who, you know, you read those stories occasionally. They do have occasion to wonder about some of those and their foes.
Well, we've gone a little over an hour, actually, but is there anything that that you think needs to be included in here that we haven't covered?
I'm sure there is.
And this is going to go on for the next year or so. So if, you know, there come occasion, we've got some things that you want to add to this, I can always come back.
All right.
I'm doing the same talking with Janet tomorrow, and then Russ on Thursday.
All right. So hopefully it won't take as much of your time as I did. Of course, Russ has been around a long time too. He'll probably bitch here for a while.
That's all right. That's what I'm here for.
One of the hallmarks of Ashley's administration, of course, was that Ashley always believed in finding the right people for the jobs involved and then letting them develop the jobs in their own ways. Ashley never micromanaged. You know, he had a sort of a tacit understanding with his managing attorneys that the administration did its laundry and they did theirs, and, you know, so as not to get the undies all mixed up. And that worked very well. In most cases, very seldom did he have to directly intervene in the day-to-day management of a section or an office, having